Right, good morning. I guess this is soft day here at the KICP, so you'll be hearing more from Eugene this afternoon on different aspects of soft theorems, but today I want to present the work that I did with Henrietta and our collaborator Stephen Schulich in this paper here at the end of last year on what I'm going to call singular soft limits. And the claim that I want to make in this talk is that understanding what we would call singular soft limits in field theories, which are massless in four dimensions and at tree level, is a problem that can be completely solved, and it can be solved in a way that is entirely on-shell and makes no reference to Feynman diagrammatics or to any kind of on-shell constructibility. So what am I talking about? We've heard a little bit in this program about soft limits already, but let me just remind you. So primarily I'm going to be talking about soft graviton theorem, but that's just for the sake of an interesting example. This work is quite broad in general. What I'm going to be talking about is what happens if you have an n+1 point graviton scattering amplitude with some matter in it and you know, various other kinds of interactions, and you study the limit in which the momentum of one of those particles is taken to zero, and you see what happens. So for the sake of being precise, I'm going to do this in a very careful way, and the way I'm going to think about this is I'm going to take my n+1 point amplitude here, and I'm going to evaluate it on a point where one of the momentum is set to zero, and that should be a singular point in momentum space. And then I'll deform around that point by some shift which depends on a complex parameter epsilon. And then I'm going to probe that soft limit by studying the amplitude on a neighborhood of the epsilon equals zero point. If you do that, if someone hands you a graviton amplitude that they've calculated, then you find this structure. You get singularities in epsilon, and not just singularities, but this peculiar structure where the amplitude factorizes into these universal soft operators and the endpoint amplitude which you get by taking that soft graviton away. And you can go away and calculate what these things are. In some sense, this, which is the Weinberg leading soft factor, has been known since the 60s. In one form or another, this was known also in the 60s, and then this was determined much later in an on-shell approach by Fichazzo and Strominger. But this is something we know very well, and it applies in all situations where you have gravity coupled minimally to matter. And that's sort of going to be the starting point of this analysis, is what we really wanted to know was how general are these soft theorems in the context of effective field theories. So there are sort of two ways you can think about this. So the motivation was to think about what happens if I'm not just talking about minimally coupled gravity anymore, but I'm talking about some effective theory of gravity, which is described by some general Lagrangian. So minimal coupling would, minimal pure gravity would just be the Einstein-Hilbert term, but now I'm going to ask what happens to this soft theorem when I include other operators, for example. And say, for another example, and every other kind of operator that you can write down that's diff invariant and compatible with the symmetries that you want. So what effect do these operators have on the soft theorems? There are two ways of thinking about what these operators mean. One is you can think about having some stringy UV completion in mind, in which case this is really asking about upper prime corrections. Or you could just think about the assumption that I'm making, which is that everything is going to be massless, as meaning that I've taken some general theory of gravity and I've integrated out all of the massive particles. And what these effective operators are supposed to be summarizing is the effect of those massive particles, so it's really summarizing massive loops. So in some indirect way, asking about corrections to the sub-leading soft graviton theorem for higher dimensional operators is the same question as asking what are the effects of loops of massive particles, but you don't have to worry about things like IR ambiguities and IR divergences because you don't have any massless particles running around in the loops. So there's going to be other motivations for this work, and I'll come to them when we get to the actual results. But for now, what I want to say is that we can think about there's a new way of thinking about what a soft limit means and where these soft singularities come from. And to get to that, I want to divert for a second. And I want to just talk about when an amplitude factorization, when an amplitude can become singular in general. So what we're doing here, as I said before, is we're taking a very particular and special point in momentum space, and we're doing a very special kind of deformation around it. So what this means is that we're taking our soft limit on the angle spinner only for a positive helicity graviton, and that's going to give us this epsilon cubed singularity of the leading order. If I had chosen a different prescription, I would have got a different power here. So in the old-fashioned power counting from Feynman diagrams, I would say that this is order 1 over p soft. I would say that this term here is order 1, and I would say that this is order p soft. So there's already something kind of funny from that point of view, which is, why should the first three orders of this expansion be universal? Maybe if we're clever enough, we'll be able to probe the next order. Maybe, but not for the same reason, is what I'm going to say in this talk. So when can an amplitude become singular in general, when we're talking about tree-level amplitudes? So let's just think about a general momentum deformation. So what I mean is, you take your momenta, and then you define them, and then you deform them in the following way, where z is some complex number. So what does it mean for an amplitude to become singular? Well, locality says that that means that you're picking a point in momentum space where some channel, some momentum channel, is going on shell. So some non-trivial subset of the external momenta is becoming null in the case of only massless particles. So there's a cartoon version of this, which I think is a little bit easier to understand, and it will help me to explain the argument that I'm going to make. So I'm going to use this script P to denote not quite momentum space, but the subspace of momentum space where on-shellness and momentum conservation are imposed. So it's some sort of non-trivial surface inside of momentum space. And these dashed lines are going to be subsurfaces within that space, corresponding to some non-trivial subset of these things going on shell. So in other words, factorization channels. So this would be, for example, the soft particle and particle 1, and this might be the soft particle and particle 2, and there are going to be a whole bunch of these kinds of surfaces. So the way I want to think about my amplitude in this deformation story is I want to think of it as evaluated on this deformation gamma. So it's a map from C into this space, and then my amplitude is a map from this space back to the complex numbers. So the first half of this story is that I'm moving along some complex contour defined in Pn plus 1, and if I cross one of these surfaces, so this is a cartoon, obviously this is supposed to be a complex curve, but every time this complex curve crosses one of these factorization channels, here and here, then if I'm studying the same amplitude in complex epsilon space, my amplitude develops a pole. And in general, there's going to be a whole bunch of them. So this is something we all know, and we also know what the residue of these poles are. So there are two things I want to say. One is that if you have this general case here, then these poles here are all simple, and their residues are all fixed by factorization. So that means that on those poles, you just get the products of the on-shell amplitudes that this thing factorizes into. So that's a little bit puzzling, that statement, given this theorem. So if all of the singularities are general momentum deformation are going to be simple poles, how is it that in the soft graviton theorem we end up with an epsilon cubed here? And that's because this statement, which is the statement of the factorization theorem, has a subtle assumption in it. And that assumption is that these singularities are what I'm going to call non-degenerate. And that means that given any singular point in the complex epsilon plane, there is a unique factorization channel that I can identify with it. So in this case, for example, this pole here might correspond to Ps plus P1 squared, but no other channel is going on shell at that time. But that's precisely what does not happen in the case of a soft limit under this deformation here. So what happens in the soft limit if I look at a channel like Ps plus PL squared under this deformation here, then I get epsilon SL SL. And the condition for that going to zero is just that epsilon is zero. And that's true for all hard lines L. What that means is that this condition, that this singular point is identified with a unique channel, is no longer true. And so factorization doesn't work. Another way to think about this is if you tried to factorize your amplitude on this pole, it would be ambiguous because you have lots of channels. It's not just breaking up into the product of two things. It kind of wants to break up into the product of multiple things. Fine. So what are we doing when we're doing a soft limit? this deformation, the one that gives you this degenerate factorization, is a different kind of complex curve, but it's one that passes through this intersection point. And in fact, that's an entirely equivalent way of thinking about what a soft limit means. You cannot think about it as being the momentum going to zero, but you instead can think about it as characterized as the point where all of the two particle channels involving that momentum are all intersecting. So what's nice about this, and the reason why I drew this cartoon picture here, is that these two cases, the one where you have non-degenerate factorization, and the degenerate case, which corresponds to the problem we actually want to solve, are continuously connected to each other. So what I can do is I can start here, and I can smoothly deform back to the case that I want. And I should be able to take the information that I know I get from factorization in this case, and use it to tell me exactly what the soft theorem is here. So how do I do this? Well, I invent a one-parameter family of curves that interpolate between these two cases, which are labeled by some complex parameter z. So the one that I actually want down here is z equals 0, and all of these other curves, these are z not equal to 0. What's the simplest way to do this? The simplest way to do this is just to remove a piece here, and then to conserve momentum, I need to add bits to these other guys. Where x here is just some arbitrarily chosen spinor. It doesn't matter what it is. Okay, now I repeat the same exercise that I had before, and I figure out where the poles are corresponding to these two particle channels. And what I find in this case is that this thing, Ps plus Pl, corresponds to this. So you can see if I set z to 0, which is equivalent to going back to the original deformation that I had, the one that I actually want to calculate, it just makes all of these poles, which are now located here, back at the origin. But for z not equal to 0, it's not significant that it's not at the origin anymore, but what's significant is that it now depends on L. So that means the degeneracy has been broken. So pictorially, the way you can think about this is that in the case of the soft limit, the original thing, is that I had a big degenerate factorization singularity here at the origin that I didn't know how to compute. So I invented a new parameter, or I invented a one-parameter family of curves, and now all of those two particle channels are now located at distinct factorization singularities located somewhere near the origin. And there are going to be other channels out here, which are not these two particle channels, but they're not going to be important. And then what I want to do is I want to take the limit as z goes to 0 and take these, and it will all migrate back to the origin. So this is going to be our strategy for attacking the soft theorem, is to use the fact that we know the factorization theorem works whenever this z parameter is in place, write down the answer, and then take the limit as z goes to 0.
I guess you don't have x equals to s. Seems that you aren't learning anything.
That's incorrect, yeah. In fact, I think that there'll be some singular problems with expressions later on if you've made that choice. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take this case with the z not equal to 0, write down all of the information that we need to recover the singularities in the z goes to 0 limit. So it's going to look something like this. It's now going to be a deformed amplitude that depends on two parameters, epsilon and z. This is going to be sum over the external legs. Some sum over states that can run in these channels. So we're only interested in factorization channels like this, S, L, and then there are a bunch of states that can run in this internal line here. And then this is just going to be the product of three-point amplitudes and the endpoint amplitude. So, what this is supposed to represent is the contributions from all the poles that lie inside of this circle. There are other factorization poles, as well as other contributions from polynomials and other things which are going to blow up at infinity, but they're totally irrelevant. All we are interested in is what is the structure of the amplitude on this neighborhood of the origin. And that's entirely captured by this factorization structure of the amplitude here, these kinds of channels. So immediately we learn something non-trivial. What we learn is that the singular structure of the amplitude, the thing we're going to get when we take z to 0, is entirely determined by these two particle channels. And that is a statement that is true at all of the subleading orders in the soft expansion. So going back to our original question of what happens in effective field theory, in the old-fashioned power counting, it's not obvious at all that these subleading orders in the soft graviton theorem can't be modified by operators of valence 4 and higher. So if I have an operator which has four fields in it, obviously it's not going to contribute to a two-particle channel, so you don't get a propagator-like singularity, but maybe it modifies it at this order or this order. This argument actually says that that can never happen. So what do we get if we do this, and then we take z to 0? Well, we should be recovering exactly what we started with without the orange deformation over there, which is the soft expansion.
Yeah, I have a question, a little confusing here, because the way how you wrote the shifts, you are basically, it's just expansion of some spinner in a basis of Sn x with these coefficients epsilon and z. So you are really taking a spinner and sending it just to 0. You are breaking that into 2 degrees of freedom. So it seems that there is some complete symmetry in epsilon and z. There is nothing special about epsilon and z.
Right.
There is no hierarchy between them.
That's right. I mean, I could have equally well done it the opposite direction and interpreted this as the soft parameter and thought of this as the other thing.
Yes.
This I don't think there's any deeper significance to that. It's just the fact that the way we've constructed the shift happens to have that symmetry.
So there's a picture of the soft limit in real momenta, which is you're just scaling all components of the momenta to 0.
Yeah,
okay, and there's a sphere of possible angles that you can integrate the soft momenta over. And whenever you, on the sphere, hit any of the directions of the hard momenta, that will be where you hit these singularities, I think, that are near 0. So it's just the regions of soft collinear overlap, I guess.
So we've learned that the soft theorems are determined entirely by these two particle channels. But it's not just that. I mean, we're dealing with four-dimensional massless particles and we're in spinner helicity, so the actual data that determines the soft theorems is very limited. It is entirely determined by these three-point amplitudes and the kind of interactions that we can have. So we can say explicitly what this is. Is this okay if I write over here? So it's entirely determined by what I'm going to call the soft data. And the soft data is just the following. It's the set of three particle amplitudes, where I have my soft particle and two other lines. And, well, if you go through the details, you'll find that you don't get any contribution unless you're looking at three particle amplitudes where some of the helicities is non-negative for a positive helicity particle going somewhere. And because we're in spinner helicity, these helicity assignments determine this amplitude uniquely up to the overall coupling constant. So the only things that determine the singular soft limits are the helicities of the three particle interactions that exist in the theory and the associated coupling constants. So we can classify the soft data in a useful way by defining this quantity I'm going to call A. So A is associated to a line that I'm going to take soft. And it's just the helicity of the soft particle minus the sum of the helicities of the remaining particles plus 1. And its interpretation is that an operator which generates a three-particle amplitude with a value of A contributes at order 1 over epsilon to the A, and then all subsequent subleading orders. So how does this work for gravity? So in the gravity case, for minimal gravity, what we have is a spin 2 graviton, which is coupling to two particles, x and x bar, which is CP conjugate, with helicities j and minus j. So the A value associated with this interaction is 2, minus 0, sum of the helicities, plus 1, which is 3. And that says that the soft graviton contributes at order 1 over epsilon cubed. Same thing with photons. This would be a 1 here, and you'd have a 1 at the start, and it would be an A of 2. And that says that it contributes at order 1 of epsilon squared, which is indeed what happens for the soft photons and gluons and things. So this is the way that we're going to try and address our question, which is, can we get contributions from operators which modify the subleading soft theorems? It means plugging in a value of A, contributing to one of those subleading orders, and asking which operators can generate these three particle interactions. Before I do that, let me just say that because this is such a constrained problem, and because the data that we need is so limited, we can actually write down an explicit expression for what the general function like this looks like. In our paper, we call it the master formula. So it's a sum over external legs, a sum over internal states, which I'll call K, some couplings. Pardon me while I write some things. So this is the general formula. You can see it has the right structure. It's got an endpoint amplitude and then some stuff. If you pick any particular values or any particular set of soft data, then what you'll find is that these soft operators, these S0s, 1s, and 2s, are all determined by the stuff in here. So you take this expression as a function of epsilon and z, and then what you want to do is you want to send z exactly to 0 and probe the amplitude on the neighborhood of 0 for epsilon. So that means you're taking a Laurent expansion of this expression with z less than epsilon, because z will eventually be 0. You need to make this assumption, otherwise you get an ambiguity when you try and do a Taylor expansion of this factor. So you get the kind of leading soft factors which are just multiplicative from this thing here, and then the derivative subleading soft operators come from doing the Taylor expansion of this here. And if you do this for the kind of minimal data that defines gravity, then you get the right answer. If you do it for photons, you get the right answer, etc. So there are two things that you could say about this. What I want to do is I want to take z to 0, but immediately you see that there's going to be some sort of peculiar obstruction to that, because I had a z in the denominator. I want to come back to this in a second. I just want to say that for now, purely pragmatically, if you wanted to determine a soft theorem for some theory, someone hands you a theory, you would calculate the soft data, you plug it in here, and then you would extract the terms which are order z to the 0. These are the soft theorems. There are these other terms which have negative powers of z, and they're actually going to give us constraints on the soft data.
So are you saying that if you don't do this assumption, because you want to set z and epsilon both of them to 0 eventually to get this expansion, but if you are not doing it like that, but different ways, like length against it, or like taking z over epsilon fixed, or something like that, you wouldn't get directly this factorization.
Well, I don't want to send them both to 0. I want to send z to 0, and I want to keep epsilon small, because I'm probing it on the neighborhood of epsilon equals 0, but not at 0.
Right, yet you have some 2 spinner, and you are sending that spinner to 0. That's the soft limit, right? And you made this choice how to rewrite it in a basis, sending first set to 0 and then expansion in epsilon. But if you do it another way, would you get a similar formula?
What other way do you have in mind? Like, what do you mean?
Well, you can rescale them both, z epsilon, taking at the same rate to 0, for example.
But I have put it some other way. But that's another limit. This is the regulator here.
I want to somehow end up, at a point like this, which is on the z equals 0 curve, but not at this intersection point. I don't want to take a limit that takes me here. It's a singular point, so I need to be somewhere off the singularity in order to see its structure.
But you could imagine scaling z and epsilon to 0 at some rate. Maybe they're not at the same power of the common thing. That's not what you want to do.
That's not what I want to do. I don't know what that would give you and what the interpretation. this is the way I want to, because this is the specific question I want to ask, which is, what is the thinking? I don't want to assume, there's no relationship between epsilon and z. They're not in some sense both soft parameters. Epsilon is the soft parameter. Z is, as Raghu said, it's a regular. It's just blowing up this singular point. Okay. All right, so let's try and answer our original question. What happens when I have these higher dimensional grids? So as I said, what that means is I take this master formula and I assume some soft data which has A values which are not contributing at order 1 over epsilon cubed. So I want either an A value of 2 or 1. So let's do the gravity case first. So subleading in gravity. This is an A value of 2. And in terms of the definition, this implies that what we're really looking for are operators which generate three-point amplitudes with the following helicity selection rule. That the sum of the helicities of the remaining two lines should sum to 1. There are no such operators. You can go look for them and you won't find them. There's a more sophisticated argument, which involves what I'll talk about in a moment, which is these constraints from the vanishing of z-poles. But the short answer is you can't find these. And so what that means is that there are no corrections to the subleading soft graviton theorem and effective field theorem. Now this result is interesting, but it actually has a kind of pleasant consequence from the point of view of all of this asymptotic symmetry stuff that Strominger has been doing, which is that in their story, well, what they're claiming is that there's some sort of CFT that lives on this celestial sphere at null infinity, and in that CFT, the stress tensor is somehow related to the subleading soft graviton theorem. There are corrections to this that come from IR singularities, but I think that they think that they can modify their prescription in some way to accommodate those. But the consequence of having the subleading soft graviton theorem in their story is that that CFT satisfies Virasoro ward identities. So the fact that this isn't receiving any corrections from effective field theory is sort of saying that that story, that there is this Virasoro symmetry on this putative CFT, is a little bit more robust. It's not just a feature of minimal Einstein gravity. Okay, so that's interesting, but not as interesting as a positive result. Let's do the sub-subleading case. So this would be an A equals 1, which implies a helicity selection rule of HL plus HK is 2. And there are operators which satisfy this. So I'll write down a few of them. There's this operator. There is. So there's this operator that couples a scalar to two copies of Riemann. Then there's another operator which couples Riemann to two copies of the field strength. And as I said, everything here that I'm saying for photons applies equally well for gluons, just modify things to have traces and appropriate structures. The helicity selection rule, anyway, is totally blind to that. And then there are also operators which couple Riemann to one gravitino. One fermion. And then there are also all the versions of these operators that you get by dualizing some of these things. So there's a phi RR tilde and an RFF tilde, and there's an operator of this which has a gamma phi inserted in here. But these are all of the operators that you can write down that will generate three-point amplitudes with this selection rule, and therefore will modify the soft graviton theorem at subleading order. So compare this with a recent paper that came out 2 weeks ago by Lada and Sen, 1706.00759, where they attacked exactly the same question using more traditional local field theory methods and got exactly this set of operators. So at least from two points of view, this is the correct answer. So what is the modification? You can obtain it just by taking this soft data and plugging it into the master formula, and the effect is that you get another term, which is at order 1 over epsilon. It looks like this. So there's a sum of the lines over internal states, the couplings. And like the leading soft graviton theorem here, it's a purely multiplicative factor. There's an epsilon factor here. And then there's a lower point amplitude. Plus, all of the non-universal pieces. Right, so this amplitude here, this A with a tilde above it, is not the same as this amplitude here. And that's a consequence of the fact that, well, so why in the usual gravity case is this amplitude universal? It's for the reason that I said before, that you're looking at factorization channels where you have a graviton coupled to a particle and its CP conjugate. And then this is feeding into the other amplitude. So the amplitude from the point of view of the particle, this particle going out, is to this particle coming in. Sorry, you know what I'm trying to say. This is the CP conjugate of this, therefore these two states are the same. So when you remove this graviton, each channel contributes the same amplitude here on the right-hand side. But that's no longer true for these kind of operators. So for example, if we were looking at this one with a phi RR, then we would have instead two gravitons. So this might be the phi here, and then this would be a graviton here, and a graviton here. And instead of getting a phi in the same position here, you'd now get a graviton. So it's not just that it gets modified in this universal way, but one of the nicest features of the soft graviton theorem, which is that it factorizes in this way, doesn't hold at sub-leading order in the presence of these operators. So you can do the same thing for electrodynamics and for gauge theory. As I said before, gauge theory, its soft expansion begins at 1 over epsilon squared. Because he wrote the paper on it. Yes.
Is there a guess for what this operator looks like in general dimensions with polarization vectors?
I think that's in this paper by Lada and Sen. They have an expression.
So I guess you should expect the sub-leaving behavior to be messed up by loops for the same reason, because you could have the loops generate an operator like this.
That's right. And that's sort of the way I want to think about these operators, is it's really summarizing loops of massive particles that I've integrated out.
The list of operators, is it dimensionally dependent?
I think so, yes. So what's, so yeah, so this, obviously this story is all 4D, and then this work was in general D, but they confirmed this list for 4D. So I would expect, yeah, you're going to get other particles, right? You're going to get two forms and other particles that maybe can interact as well, so.
And I just wanted to say that the sub-leading order is messed up even in the massless case, when you go loops.
Well, the loops will probably have operators like this in their UV behavior, right?
It's related to it, probably. Yeah, well, this is just
the
massless case. So you're not integrating out a massless field.
I'm saying you have divergences in the massless case.
It's the L plus case, even the finite amplitudes have it.
Even the case where there isn't any possibility of seeing the counterterms.
It shouldn't be too surprising.
So how do you know you can't see the counterterms in the all plus case?
Because it's only one loop, right where it's finite.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think single minus actually where it's broken.
So as I was saying, the same thing happens in electrodynamics, but in electrodynamics your expansion begins at order 1 over epsilon squared, so you can get corrections at sub-leading order from 1 over epsilon, which is an A equals 1 operator, which in electrodynamics is this kind of selection rule. Oops, sorry, there's a 1. And you can write down what all the operators are. There's one operator which couples your photon to gravity minimally. And then there is another operator which couples a scalar to Fs. And then another operator which couples a photon to fermions. So it's sort of interesting to think about what this might mean physically, because obviously some of these operators have nice interpretations. This is how an axion would couple to the electromagnetic field. This is the Pauli dipole operator that modifies the anomalous magnetic moment. So it's not implausible to think that maybe from this asymptotic symmetry point of view that somehow the moments, the electric and magnetic moments, are somehow being modified by the presence of these operators, and that's really what's modifying the sub-leading soft photon theorem. But anyway, that's something maybe to think about in the future. You get a multiplication.
Scalar coupling to F squared.
Yes, yes. So it's the same thing as I had before. You can replace things with their duals, and you'll also get the same things. So the usual soft photon theorem. I'm not going to write out what these operators are. It's the same form where you have these universal operators. This is just a Weinberg. This is a factor. This is a differential operator. And then the modification looks like a kind of sum with the same structure.
Some of these binaries modification kind of a non-kinematic remix or this kind of a structure where there is some skew on this bracket and there is a single power. So you can distinguish between them. And there's a host in general, so they never mix whatever.
Right. Well, this amplitude and this amplitude can never be the same.
But can you, if I already hand you the full result, would you be able to dig in?
Oh,
right.
I mean, I did couplings here. Can I see the couplings?
Yeah, but well, if you have it as a special couplings, yes.
I mean, in general, I don't know. If I can't see the couplings, then you just give me a mix, and I look at the 1 over epsilon pieces. Maybe I can't disentangle them without
ordering. Can you tell by the angular behavior or the?
Oh, that's what it looks like because the angular behavior seems different.
So it's exactly the same structure in the electrodynamics case. You just have a 1 power here instead of 3 power. The same story about the amplitude being different. Okay. So that was the question that we wanted to answer originally. Now I want to go back to something that I mentioned before. How much time do I have? A little bit of time. So, something I mentioned before, which is that if you look at this master formula, naively you can't take the z to 0 limit. And that's because there are poles in z. So that's puzzling, and it's puzzling because from the point of view of the deformation up there, it's a totally innocent thing to do. I know that I can take my amplitude and I can evaluate it on the z equals 0 deformation and I get a sensible answer. But this story seems to say that if I do this fancy thing where I do the factorization first with z in place and then take the limit, I can't take z to 0. There's another reason why this is puzzling, which is that locality tells me when my amplitude is allowed to become singular. It's allowed to become singular only when a channel goes on shell. But if I check for generic epsilon not equal to 0, whether there's a factorization singularity at z equals 0, the answer is always no. So the presence of a pole in z would indicate that the amplitude has a spurious singularity somewhere, which means the locality is being violated. So these z singularities can't be here. What does that mean? That means that there must be a conspiracy among the sums over the external legs and the internal states such that these spurious poles cancel. So let me try and explain what that means in terms of an example. I'm going to call these soft constraints. So, if I have an A value which is greater than 1, then this Z here is going to contribute to me a power of Z which is of order 1 over Z to the A minus 1. So if I have an A of 3 in gravity, for example, then I'm going to get a pole in Z at order 1 over Z squared, and then subsequent subleading orders. So let's play a game. And this game is, I'm going to tell you that I have a theory in mind, and this theory has a spin 2 particle, and it couples to CP conjugate states, just like gravity. Except unlike just like gravity, I'm going to imagine that it couples to particles with different strengths. This is a perfectly sensible set of soft data, at least naively. And I can plug that into this formula, and I can ask what the soft theorems are. When I try and take the z to 0 limit, and I do this Laurent expansion, I get poles in z. What does the leading pole look like? It looks like some sum over the 1 over z squared pole, some sum over the couplings, and some factor like this times the amplitude. So what I said was that for this theory to not violate locality, these poles had to cancel. So you stare at this for a while, and you realize the same thing that Weinberg realized in 1965, when he arrived at the same expression but through a different argument, which is that there's only one way that this thing can disappear, and that is if the coupling is universal, it factors out of the sum, And then what is left vanishes by momentum conservation. So what this says is that any theory of a spin, massless spin two particle which couples to particles like this has to couple universally, otherwise it's inconsistent with locality. So it's got a 1 over z squared pole, and it also has 1 over z poles. It has two of them, in fact. One of them vanishes for the same reason when you make the assumption of the universal coupling. The other one is a little bit more interesting. It comes from taking the Taylor expansion here, so it has a derivative in it. And you can probably guess, if you've seen Svi's paper from a few years ago, what's going to happen, which is that you're going to get an operator in here, which in the case where you pick the coupling to be universal, is the generator of the Lorentz group. And that acting on the amplitude gives zero. So all of these poles cancel, sort of miraculously, for the case of minimal gravity. You can do the same thing with electrodynamics, which is that you can put a photon here, and then you can ask, well, if I have different coupling strengths to different particles, which is the same as saying different electric charges, I get the same sort of constraint without these factors in the numerator, and then the associated constraint is that the sum of the charges have to be zero. So this is, again, the Weinberg argument for the conservation of electric charge, purely on shot. Slightly more interesting example. A slightly more interesting example is to ask what happens if I have soft data, which is defined by having a graviton which couples to a Rarita-Schwinger field of spin 3/2, a massless field. Now, I can take a soft limit on the Rarita-Schwinger field, and I have an associated A value. So what is the A value? So, A associated with this particle, let's call it psi, is 3/2 minus the sum of the helicities of the remaining particles, so 2 minus 3/2 plus 1. And what is that? That's 2. So that says that the soft theorems for a gravitino, well, it's going to turn out to be a gravitino, but a Rarita-Schwinger field, always begin at order 1 over epsilon squared, and that I get a pole of order 1 over z. So what is the coefficient of this pole? In other words, what's the thing that I have to cancel, or I have to demand cancels, in order for this theory to be consistent with locality? It's exactly what you might expect. It's what you get by acting on the endpoint amplitude with a supersymmetry generator. In other words, the condition that the pole vanishes is that the amplitudes in this theory satisfy the supersymmetry water identities. So this is an on-shell proof of the fact that the only consistent theory of a massless spin 3/2 particle coupled to gravity is the supergravity.
So these constraints, they also follow from the factorization of the four-point amplitude. Do you get something beyond that? Does the soft limit no more than that?
Well, this doesn't just come from the four-point amplitude.
It does. If you do four-point amplitude from spin 3/2 fields, in order to have it consistent, you need to supersymmetrize it.
Right. This says the four-point amplitudes are supersymmetric. This says that the endpoint amplitudes satisfy the water identities, which is a stronger statement.
Well,
are you referring to there's a paper by Magatti and Rodina?
Yes. So I'm asking if there is something, because there might be more constraints beyond the four-point amplitudes, because they derive something for four-point, but it's not clear if the high-point amplitudes know more than just that. I'm asking if there is some example in this sort of constraints which would be.
Of course, they know more because you don't have to be MHV at high-point.
You don't have to be MHV. Right, well, for four-point, we're to get MHV.
Yeah. I think the fact that this is a statement about endpoint amplitudes is a stronger statement than what they obtained in their paper. They were just talking about the fact that the spectrum has to be the spectrum of supergravity.
Right.
But this is saying that whatever other interactions you have in your Lagrangian that defines your theory, those have to be compatible with these water identities, otherwise your theory violates locality. And those operators can be valence higher than 4, or it could be whatever you want them to be. All right. So, final example. I'm going to claim that these soft constraints have something interesting to say about higher spin particles. So, this begins with a lemma. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say I have a three-particle amplitude in my theory, where I'm going to use A, B, and C to denote some internal quantum numbers. And so this three-particle amplitude is kinematically determined up to a coupling, FABC. And I'm going to say that I know this is in my soft data. And since my theory is Lorentz invariant, it should satisfy the CPT theorem. Therefore, I should also have the CP conjugate amplitude, which I'll denote with a bar. And the coupling constant associated with this should be the complex conjugate of the coupling associated with the one at the top. So if I know that this is in my soft data, then I can begin to ask about the soft constraints associated with the following four-point amplitude. So S is the particle I'm going to take soft. And what I've done is I've engineered this four-point amplitude so that these two particles have CP conjugate quantum numbers, and these two particles have CP conjugate quantum numbers. Therefore, I know that this four-point amplitude has at least one factorization channel involving this operator here, or this amplitude here. And it's the one that you get from just having S1, 2, 3. Now, I don't know what else is in my theory, so in principle, I could also have the T and U channel diagrams. So let's suppose now that I have an A value which is greater than 3. That means I'm going to get some pole. Let's say it's A equals 4, then that means I'm going to get a pole of order 1 over Z cubed. So what's the associated factor, what's the analog of this thing, that would have to vanish for this theory to be consistent? It's the following. So my n plus 1 point, sorry, my 4-point amplitude contains a 1 over z to the a minus 1 pole. Let's write it out like this. S1 to the a minus 1, sorry, a minus 2. 1 plus So B1, B2, and B3 are basically contributions of everything else that comes from the propagator and the amplitude on the right-hand side of the factorization channel. And the only property that you really need to know at this point is that the BIs are independent of this angle S. This is something you can do by hand. So what are we going to do? Well, if A is greater than 3, then this power here is at least 2. So I can differentiate off one power by acting with the operator P, where P is some arbitrarily chosen spinner, derivative in S. So what that does is it strips off a power here and gives me factors of P. Notice I wouldn't have been able to do that if A was equal to 3. And because I now have these two independent spinners that appear in this expression, I can make the choice that P is 2 and S is 3 and kill these terms. So what this means is that if A is greater than 3, the soft constraints have to be satisfied in each channel individually. So they have to be satisfied in this diagram alone. So what is in this B1? Well, it's just some overall kinematic factors that come from the amplitudes. The only thing that could potentially save us and make this zero is if the sum over the internal quantum number that is running in this channel, which I'll call C, sums up to zero. But this B1, this is proportional to, up to some non-vanishing kinematic factor, the sum over the product of the couplings. But the couplings are complex conjugate, therefore this is the sum over the mod square of the coupling. So the only way that this can be zero, only if the couplings are zero. So that proves the lemma that it's impossible in a local quantum field theory to have any amplitude for which this A value is greater than 3. So what's this got to do with higher spin? Well, suppose I told you that I had a higher spin particle and gravity. So I'm going to call this particle X, R minus J. I know I have to have this interaction in my theory, because the equivalence principle demands that everything has to couple to gravity, and everything has to couple to gravity with the same strength. So I have no choice of setting the couplings to zero. Therefore, the only way that this interaction can be consistent is if the A value is associated with it are less than 3. If I take this X particle soft, I also get an A value. What do I get? I get J minus the sum of the helicities of the two remaining particles, plus 1, which is 2J minus 1. And the lemma said this was consistent with locality only if A is less than or equal to 3. This means that my spin has to be less than or equal to 2. So massless higher spin particles are inconsistent with locality, at least from the point of view of the amplitudes. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. I just want to close by just recapping what we did. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to understand how the soft theorems in effective field theories are modified by the presence of effective operators, specifically in the context where we have only massless particles, we're in 4 dimensions, and we're at tree level. So in terms of where to go from here, whether these arguments generalize, the real sticking point for these two is that this is really boiling down to the fact that this is all done in spin helicity. You can do massive particles in spin helicity in 4D. That's not such an interesting case. More interesting is what happens when you go beyond D equals 4. This is why I was asking Donald the other day if he could teach me everything he knows about spin helicity in higher dimensions. Because there are interesting other cases that happen that this doesn't capture. Like what happens for the subleading soft theorems for two forms and other fields in higher dimensions. Beyond tree level, it's a little bit less clear whether this argument or type of argument can generalize because the analytic structure of the amplitude is modified. This relies very heavily on the fact that the amplitude at tree level is a rational function with poles, but at loop level you have cuts and other sorts of awful non-analytic features. So this is sort of where we'd like to go from here. Anyway, thank you very much.
If I take the limit in string theory that the tension goes to 0, then naively I get an infinite number of massless higher spin fields.
Massless higher spin in flat space?
Yeah, they have mass proportional to the string tension. Usually we think of them very heavy, but if you take the tension to 0, then they all pile up at 0. I just wondered if there's any loophole here in the case of a pathological spectrum with an infinite number of particles, if you can see any.
I don't think so.
Are at 0 tension due to the exponential falloff of the amplitude anyway, the theory is free.
So you think that's the way out, is that they don't couple in this limit?
Well, yeah, that would certainly be a sort of trivial loophole to this argument. If you have massless high-spin particles that are totally invisible from the point of view of all of the lower spin particles,
then this argument doesn't work.
But if it's still coupling to the graviton with the universal strength, these massless high-spin particles, then I would say that that's a single limit. It doesn't really exist. There are other arguments for the same conclusion.
Here you can directly I think it completes the equivalent argument that there is no 4-point amplitude which factorizes into 3 points.
If you scale out the factor of epsilon of your z, like you really want to resolve and call your z something like epsilon lambda, I couldn't quite feel your expansion over there, but if you now expand, if you do the same kind of expansion, except that you want your function of lambda and stuff, do you still have these constraints coming from, do you still have first negative powers of lambda?
Sorry, what did you want to do?
I want to call lambda z lambda epsilon.
I want to call z lambda epsilon. Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay.
And I want to do the same, I'm asking if you do the same expansion over there, the function of lambda, sorry, a is a function of lambda, do you still find constraints associated to negative powers of lambda?
Is lambda a parameter I'm going to take to 0, or is it just a fixed
ratio?
Yeah,
it's kind of the parameter you want to take to 0 first, or wait.
Naively?
No, sorry. Lambda is just fixed. It's like z in your expression.
Right. I think not. I think if I take z here to be proportional to epsilon, which is what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
Then if I compute where all of my 2-particle channels are involving S and a hard line, they're still all going to be proportional to epsilon by that argument I gave before. So you're still going to end up with PS plus PL, it's an L, sorry, L squared being basically epsilon times some junk. And therefore, all the products are bigger. Right. So I haven't broken the degeneracy. So I think that's, yeah, this is not a valid thing to do.
Isn't this what Lance was saying? That you're just saying that different things have up in different directions on this, like a spinner?
That seems like a reasonable interpretation.
Other questions for Cal? All right, let's thank him again.